This is an ABC podcast.
Pōpongi mā nea, tūro ora mai. Good morning, Nen Blong me, Johnson Raira. This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. If you're a long-time listener to Pacific Beach and you're wondering if you're listening to the right show, I can assure you, you are. I'm usually co-hosting the ABC Australia TV show The Pacific, but this morning I'll be filling in for our sister Aggie Dubol. Now, let's take a look at what's coming up on the show today. Solomon Islands government investigates millions of dollars in missing mine payments.
I think the so-called resource curse is something that I see in the context of the Solomons. I think we need to strengthen the structures around them, the laws.
Oxford University will award pioneering Māori scholar Makariti Papakura her degree 94 years after her death. And later in the show, Indigenous Women's Rugby League team from Australia compete in Samoa for the first time.
So it's going to be a massive opportunity for the girls to get out. So not just footy skills, but the complete immersion into villages and having conversations and just sharing story.
Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Guns have long been a way of life in New Caledonia, both among Indigenous Kanak people and French settlers. While hunting of deer, pigs and flying fox may be a national pastime, firearm ownership has skyrocketed in recent years, and experts fear stockpiling is not being driven by hunting, but by the ongoing threat of civil unrest. Kyle Evans has the story.
When Murray Thomas ventured to New Caledonia in 1982, it wasn't sun, sea and sand he was hunting. It was the Roosa deer.
New Caledonia's traditionally been known as growing the biggest ones in the world, so they're quite sought after, the antlers.
Murray spent 37 years leading guided tours through New Caledonia's rural terrain. He felt at home among Indigenous Kanak locals who, like him, love to hunt as a means to make a living.
It's a huge percentage of venison that they live on. That's the main reason that they have guns. So there's a lot of weekend hunting going on, but there's also a lot of midweek hunting where property owners were shooting a lot of black market venison and selling it through different outlets.
But over the last decade, this much-beloved pastime has had an unintended consequence. Rates of gun ownership have risen dramatically after restrictions were lifted in 2011 so people could own as many guns as they wanted to make hunting easier. Gun sales tripled. And 2 years later, the Noumea-based think tank Centre for Common Destiny estimated more than 100,000 firearms were circulating in the territory, thousands of them unregistered. In a petition to the French government, it wrote the following.
It's harder to buy a case of beer on the weekend in New Caledonia. If New Caledonia were a sovereign state, it would be the second most armed country in the world behind the US.
A 2016 study from the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime cited similar figures, showing New Caledonia was the most armed place in the Pacific by a long way. More worryingly, the study cites anecdotal reports which attributes the stockpiling not to hunting, but concerns over civil unrest. Patrick Lebrow witnessed as much during last year's deadly riots in Noumea, where gunshots rang out in the streets.
A policeman was shot dead just a few yards from where I live here. We could hear the gunshots, you know, all the time.
Having hunted in his younger years, he knows a hunting rifle when he sees one. But Mr. Lebrow said many of the weapons being used during the riots weren't designed to hunt animals.
Those weapons that were used were not hunting weapons. I mean, they were weapons especially procured for this sort of activity. And that is distressing, yeah.
History says stockpiling has occurred in both Indigenous and non-Indigenous sections of the community. Senior lecturer and New Caledonia historian at Victoria University of Wellington, Adrian Muckle, says Kanaks in rural areas stockpiled weapons, as did French descendant communities, particularly during Civil War periods of the 1980s.
some of the worst acts of violence during that period, or some of the most notorious ones were involved use of weapons by descendants of settlers against Kanak. I think that fear exists on both sides, but it's been especially evident in the sort of European settler community. Yeah.
This week marks 12 months since the latest outbreak of violence that left 13 people dead, businesses destroyed, and the territory's economy in ruins. The spark that lit the underlying tensions was voting reforms to give voting rights to French settlers who had lived in New Caledonia for 10 years. Noumea Chamber of Commerce President David Gwene says economic conditions 1 year on are worse than what they were during the COVID pandemic.
You can summarise the past year, the past 12 months as of despair, of anger, sadness, bankruptcies. Those were the mindset of the business community for the whole year, and that's what we're trying to change now, because we cannot stay in this state forever.
However, things may get worse before they get better. Last week, formal negotiations to forge a new political agreement around New Caledonia's future fell apart. With another election set for November, Mr. Muckle said political and social conditions that sparked the riots 12 months ago were still the same.
The more general level of insecurity and instability, sort of economic, social, political, is as high as ever. And there's a lot of, there's some big question marks now about what happens over the next few months.
We head to Papua New Guinea now, where 8 people, including 4 school children, have been kidnapped at a remote village, Adamari, in Western Province. The alleged kidnappers are reported to be demanding a ransom, and police are warning they'll use lethal force if the hostages are not released. For more on this developing story, we go to Port Moresby to speak to ABC's Papua New Guinea correspondent Marion Farr. Good morning, Marion. Thank you for joining us. But before we get into the latest news on this, when did this kidnapping happen?
Good morning, John. So according to police, this kidnapping occurred early in the morning on Monday this week, about 5 a.m. That's when this gang is said to have seized these 4 adults and a group of children in the village of Adamari, which is in Western Province near the border with Hela and Southern Highlands Province. It's a very sort of remote area. We understand the attack happened very early in the morning while the victims were asleep in their homes or their school accommodation. And at this stage, it's unclear exactly where they've been taken.
You say it's unclear where they've been taken, but what's the latest, any other developments about the incident?
Well, we've learned a few things. One is that there was one schoolgirl who managed to evade the kidnappers when they were trying to seize her. That's the understanding that police have. She wasn't actually captured, but when they were coming in and trying to take these hostages, she managed to escape. And it's understood that she's now cooperating with the police and helping them with their investigation. Apparently she ran away to a nearby village to safety and raised the alarm. It's still early days, but specialist police from Port Moresby have been sent to respond to the incident, and they are there on the ground now.
What about the hostages? Are there details that we know about them, and any other details around who was kidnapped?
So according to police, there were 4 adults and a number of children, school-aged children, who were captured. The adults are believed to be a school teacher and his wife, and also a health worker and his wife. Police haven't been able to confirm the number of children who were kidnapped at this stage, but local media are reporting that 4 school-aged girls are among the hostages. Police also say they believe the hostages have not been harmed, which is obviously good news if that's the case, and the focus now is really to keep it that way and to bring them to safety.
You mentioned that police have a specialist team that is responding to this. Do you know of any of the challenges that police are facing in getting to the area?
Well, I mean, this is a very remote area. Western Province is the largest province in PNG, and it's not well connected in terms of sort of roads and airports. Police haven't confirmed exactly how they reached the area, but from the kind of sources we have, it's understood that there's a helicopters were actually involved in getting the police to this remote location.
Now, police are labelling the kidnappers as domestic terrorists. What exactly does that term mean?
Yeah, so John, this is a term that's really started to enter the PNG police lexicon in the last year or so, I guess around the time of the passing of PNG's new counter-terrorism laws. Now, that that legislation describes terrorism, and you have to bear with me, this is a bit legalistic, but it describes terrorism as an act or threat of personal harm or serious property damage undertaken for the purpose of either advancing a political, religious or ideological cause, influencing government action or policy, creating fear or a serious risk to the health or safety of the public or any section of the public, intimidating the public or any section of the public, or affecting a group or groups of persons identifiable by a shared custom, ethnicity or place of residence. So police are referring to these kidnappers in their sort of media releases. They're referring to them as domestic terrorists, which is consistent with how they've labelled kidnappers and people who do these sort of activities in the past. And it's an indication that they could be dealt with under this Counter-Terrorism Act, which carries very, very severe penalties. I think some of them, have some of the offences, or most of the offences, have a minimum imprisonment term of 50 years and a maximum life sentence. So, some very serious penalties there for people who are charged and found guilty under that act.
Now, just finally, Marion, is this an isolated incident?
Not exactly, John. There have been kidnappings in this particular area in the past. You might remember in 2023, an Australian archaeologist and his team were captured in the very similar area. Local sources have indicated that it could be the same gang responsible this time around, but that's not something police have been able to confirm at this stage. And, the kidnappers are demanding a ransom, which is similar to what has happened in the past. In the past, with that Australian archaeologist, they were targeting an expatriate. This time we understand that the victims, the hostages, are all Papua New Guinean nationals, and police have reiterated that this is not the first time that this has happened in that region, and they are working to respond based on, their experience in the past and their experience dealing with these sort of situations.
Thank you, Lu Time Blow You. Thank you for your time, Marion.
Thank you, Drew Johnson.
That's ABC's PNG correspondent, Marion Farr.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, staying in the Solomons, the Solomon Islands government has announced the establishment of a commission of inquiry to investigate millions of dollars in missing mine payments. Mines Minister Derek Manuari announced the commission of inquiry just a week after taking up office. He says the commission will investigate what happened to money from 33 shipments of bauxite from the country's southern province of Rennell between 2017 and 2019. The controversy over the missing payments has been the subject of political debate that saw a motion of no confidence moved against Prime Minister Jeremiah Manili.
After the 33 shipments, there were other shipments afterwards. But what those shipments are, they were paid. They were paid by the royalties were duly paid by the company. There are a lot of things where ministry could and couldn't do. The ministry at that time too, him no got him any substantive director for the, especially the period where there were 33 shipments. So in terms of administrative due diligence, there was also this challenge. It happened over different periods, different administrative, different governments and different administrative executives. so that we ensure that whatever is due to the people and government and paid. Law records from Ifala, SIG is owed more than $4 million, and the landowners is owed more than $3 million. And the province itself, more than $800,000, Solomon dollars. And this is a very big amount of money where Law Mining Act of Lumi is required to be paid to all these parties that have never been paid in terms of the legislation, looking at the loopholes that are there. And as you know, we have a new act that is now before Parliament. And that act has taken into account a lot of the things, the weaknesses that are legislative weaknesses that are there. It will be a legislation that will help to address a lot of these issues that at the moment, we don't have any legislative instrument for himself addressing. But I think what is most important, semi-talent and finish, is learning from this experience. We cannot deny that the issue Lauren Bell was, to all parties involved, was a mess.
Solomon Islands new Mines Minister Derek Manuari speaking there to journalists at a press conference in Solomon Islands capital, Honiara. Now, one Solomon Islands MP in full support of the Commission of Inquiry is the leader of the Independents, Peter Kinaloria Jr. Mr. Kinaloria Jr. has long advocated for greater regulations on the harvesting of natural resources and has expressed particular concern over the presence of China-owned mining companies in the Solomons. Finau Fonua spoke with Peter Kinaloria Jr.
I welcome the call, the initiative by the new Minister for Mines to establish a commission of inquiry into particularly the shipment of minerals from a particular province and island in Ranelagh and Bellona. That issue has been ongoing now for years, and I think it's the right step taken by the newly appointed Minister for Mines to take that initiative. I think that is the right way to do it in terms of having a commission of inquiry looking into this particular shipments, some 33 shipments of bauxite, particularly bauxite from these particular islands in the Solomons, and I welcome that.
Countries that are often blessed with minerals also are often vulnerable to exploitation.
Right.
Do you see that with the Solomon Islands?
Yeah, I think the so-called resource curse is something that I see in the context of the Solomons, that it is there. And I think it comes down to the governance of these resources, the proper governance of them, the management of them. I think we need to strengthen the structures around them, the laws around them, to ensure that we minimize as much as possible corruption that does come in terms of these natural resources as well, as we see in other parts of the world that are also equally rich, but probably much more richer in terms of these natural resources. But I still believe that the laws around these resources will need to be strengthened in order to protect them as well as protect the resource owners. And I've been calling for this particular issue, for a while now, in terms of the need to strengthen these resources, particularly in the context of our new diplomatic relations with China, and why it's really important to strengthen those laws when we do get into relationships with a powerful country that has powerful interests in resources.
When you say in particular with China, are you referring to concerns about the exploitation of resources by Chinese companies?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that I've been very consistent in my call for this. You know, 5-6 years ago when we did the switch, that I said we weren't ready. We need to strengthen our laws to ensure our resources are protected, our people, the resource owners are protected, to ensure that the exploitation doesn't happen. And I said that in the context of what I saw happening around the world already at that time and even now. And I still stand by my position on that. It's very important to ensure that our resources and the people that own these resources are protected. And it's incumbent upon our government to do that. You know, we fail our people when we don't do that. And I say that in the context of the fact that there are 19 Chinese mining companies now apparently operating here in Solomon Islands. And that is a concern. And we will need to ensure that the laws are strong enough to protect those resources and ensure that when they are harvested or extracted or mined, that the best possible outcome is there for both the people as well as the environment.
That was Peter Kinaloria Jr., leader of the Independents in the Solomon Islands Parliament. He was speaking to ABC's Whenau Whanua.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now it's time to get to the headlines from around the region, and I'm joined now in studio with our producer, Jordan Fennell. Good morning.
Good morning, Johns. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And it's so lovely to be joined by somebody else in the studio. But to our news headlines, let's start in Fiji, where drama continues to unfold with the ruling coalition. What's the latest there?
Oh my goodness, Johns. This political drama... it's just, the tea is crazy.
Look, I'm all for tea, but I don't know about this tea.
Yeah, so what's happened is Fiji Times is reporting that Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka has declared a breach of trust inside his ruling coalition. Now, the backstory for this is swipes being thrown back and forth between different parts of the coalition at the moment. Just a reminder for everyone, Fiji's government is made up of three political parties, the People's Alliance Party, led by Mr. Rambuka, the National Federation Party, and SODELPA. Now, last week, SODELPA's General Secretary, Viliame Takayawa, recently publicly criticised Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister over a trade mission to Tonga. Now, Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, did not appreciate the public criticism and threatened to sever the coalition. Then Mr. Takayawa publicly apologised to the Prime Minister and everything seemed well. The Prime Minister accepted that apology. Things were smoothed over. On Mother's Day, Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka said, quote, Fiji is too small for people to be saying unkind things about each other. But now, Fiji Times is reporting that tensions are back, with Fiji's Prime Minister saying that the bubble has burst, actually, and Fiji's government is going to proceed with caution when it comes to dealing with their coalition partner, SODELPA.
Also proceeding with caution is Aotearoa New Zealand, because health authorities are concerned about a measles case there. What's the latest?
So Radio New Zealand Pacific is reporting that a measles case was reported in Auckland over the weekend. It was a ferry worker who was apparently infectious while at work. Health authorities are encouraging people to get vaccinated, especially Pacific populations in Aotearoa New Zealand. Measles is, of course, a very highly infectious disease that can be deadly, especially for unvaccinated children. And doctors in New Zealand say Pacific communities in particular are susceptible because of low vaccination rates. At the moment, New Zealand health data says that just about 70% of Pacific babies were vaccinated against measles as of December 2024. This is, of course, very concerning for populations from the Pacific that are moving back and forth between New Zealand and other countries, like in Samoa. They will no doubt be keeping a close eye on what is happening. Of course, back in 2019, the export of measles from New Zealand did lead to the deaths of more than 80 people, especially children, so one to keep an eye on.
And finally, let's head to Papua New Guinea, where it seems like the Western province just can't seem to catch a break, because earlier this morning we were talking with our ABC PNG correspondent Marion Farr around the kidnappings in the Western province, and now there's been some flooding. What do we know?
Yeah, there's been quite heavy rains and severe raining in PNG's Western province, causing rivers and lakes to swell. That means that schools, health centres and houses have been flooded out and some are completely underwater. And it's not just Western province, actually. It's also in Madang province as well. Locals reporting to the Post Courier that once the rain started a couple of days ago, they weren't sleeping. They were just waiting to see if there would be flash flooding. And when it did happen, then they had to flee. Locals have also told Post Courier that flooding in the area has been a recurring problem for many years, and they are calling on PNG's government to assist, but they say so far they have not gotten a response.
Jordan Fennell, thank you so much for bringing us those updates from across the Pacific region.
Not a worries.
Oxford University has announced it will be honouring one of its alumni, the late Makariti Papakura, with a posthumous degree. Born in 1873, Miss Papakura was a pioneering Māori scholar who enrolled at Oxford University in 1922. She became a widely regarded researcher, providing her insight of Māori culture and language at the time when it was marginalised. Tragically, Papakura passed away in 1930, just weeks before she was due to present her thesis. Whenau Whanua spoke with Papakura's great-niece, Ms. June Grant.
We were really excited because we've been waiting for this for a long time. Several years ago, we knew that there were a lot of young academics and scholars going to the university, and they always accessed her notes from the Pitt River Museum. All her notes were put into the museum. And it was such a scholarly work and such an academic piece of writing that we knew that it should be out there, which it has been for a number of years. It's been in all our libraries, but it should have been acknowledged as a degree, because the bad luck was that she died before she presented her papers for examination. She only died 3 weeks before it was presented. So it was sort of waiting for a long, long time, 95 years, in fact. We've been waiting for this to be acknowledged as a bona fide degree, which is like a reality for us that she actually got her degree. So it's a Master's of Philosophy in Anthropology, which is a very appropriate name for her study. And her study is wonderful. It's all about our people and the people in the village where she lived. So everything she writes about are our customary practices, how we lived every day, who we acknowledged, what our familial situations were in terms of marriage, birth, life, death, childbirth, the maramataka, honouring the sciences of our life. And so this is like a wonderful volume of work for us to read 100 years later and validate all that she has written about. So yeah, we're pretty excited and pretty humbled by the fact that Oxford University considered it worthy of this honour.
And it's certainly worthy, given the valuable information in it. As you pointed out, she revealed a lot about the Māori customs, and this was in the early part of the century. Could you describe what exactly she wrote about?
Well, we were living communally then, of course. It was the early 20th century, but we had been in processes of having other people colonise our country. So we were learning another way of life, which was to speak another language. And so some of our traditions were lost. And at the time that our grandmother had decided to go to university in England, which was by accident, because she had gone there in the first instance to be at the coronation of King George and Queen Mary. And she fell in love with an Englishman and she married and she stayed in England. So she obviously thought that she was going to come back to New Zealand at some stage. But as it happened, she did not. So she enrolled at Oxford University to write the story of her people. At the time that she left New Zealand, she was being told by lots of historians and people that the Māori language was on its way out, that it was becoming redundant and that nobody would be speaking it anymore. So she went to try and make sure that she captured all of our history, our customary practices, our arts, especially our language. And she would be really, she'd be doing a little jig up there in heaven because she knows that that's what happened, that we did retain that.
And she must be a role model as well for Māori. I mean, going to Oxford, and this was in the early 20th century, and she was a woman. Could you describe that?
Well, that was difficult too, because at the stage that she matriculated, which means she enrolled in 1926, I think, and they hadn't been enrolling women at Oxford. It was a men-only institution for education. So even her work, when she was writing about her tribal life, was dismissed as sort of like women's work. It was like, oh, what sort of validation does that have in our world? When in fact, it's the centre of our lives in terms of how we are as people. It's our customary practices that make us, educate us in the way we are and the way we behave and the way we see our world. So her work was very important to have that recorded. And she had decided that she was going to write everything down just in case it did fade out into obscurity.
It is sad that she didn't get to read her study. What did she pass away from, and could you describe that a bit?
She had a heart attack, but she was only 58 when she passed away, which seems very young. That was very young to pass away. Yeah, we regret that we didn't have time with her, but she's alive every time we open her book and read her pages. So that's a lovely legacy that she's left for us and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren. And we number in the hundreds now, because she was also very attractive, and attractive women get great husbands. So
that's true. Oh, well, not all the time. last question, her legacy and her contributions to Māori academia. How much has she contributed to Māori studies?
I think that even knowing that, you know how we have role models in life and you think, you know, I can be like them, I can be like that person. I'm just happy that she has been profiled at last, because it's been a long time, it's been 100 years. And that's really important for us, because it's validating her knowledge and her inspiration to our young people.
That was June Grant, the great-niece of famed Māori scholar Makariti Papakura. She was speaking there to ABC's Whenau Whanua. Samoa NRL have invited an Indigenous women's rugby league team from Australia to visit the Pacific Nation to play rugby league and exchange cultural ties. The Murray Gummers, a team of First Nations women and girls, have been making strides in the world of grassroots rugby league, and this trip to Samoa will be their first time to compete internationally. Shani Higgity is the team manager of the Murray Gummers and spoke with our reporter Jordan Fennell.
We're taking two teams, a team of an under-17s team and a women's team. So there's 34 players, and then the rest that make up the 45 are cultural advisors. So we're taking, you know, obviously our coaches and a team of cultural advisors. So we've got some family members that have joined us from our husband's family in traveling from New Zealand to meet the girls in Brisbane, then fly with us as a team to Samoa as cultural advisors. So we've got, you know, the support for language, for cultural protocols, for them to have the confidence to, when they're in Samoa, that we're doing the right thing. The girls, you know, we've got interpreters and people to advise, you know, and just language interpreters as well as cultural interpreters. So as well as our own cultural advisors from Australia. So we've got a Torres Strait Islander elder, as well as an Aboriginal elder, and some definitely cultural advisors, but musicians as well, so we can share culture when we get there, dancers and, you know, Yidaki players, so that we can share some of our culture. while we're there.
Obviously, while you're there, you'll be playing rugby league games.
Yes.
But this tour also has a cultural knowledge sharing component. What is that going to look like?
Yeah, it's going to be a massive immersion for the girls. Some of these girls are coming from communities that are extremely rich in culture. Others, you know, are, I would say, more urbanized. So the lack of culture for some of these girls is going to be a culture shock as well, both our own First Nations culture and Samoan culture. So we've got girls that are coming from, like I said, all over Queensland. We've got girls that are coming from the Northern Territory and Katherine. We've got girls that are coming from Western Australia, girls that are coming up from, you know, down south in New South Wales. So all different cultures that they're going to share. So all of these girls are bringing their own individual songs, stories, dances, experiences that they're going to share with each other and when we get to Samoa. And I'm looking forward, you know, we're going to be in Samoa when Te Wila Festival is on. So it's going to be a massive opportunity for the girls to get out, you know, every night and just experience culture firsthand, but then also go into the villages, go into the schools and exchange culture that way. So not just footy skills, but the complete immersion into villages and having conversations and just sharing story.
I understand one of the important aspects of this is for the Murray-Gummers girls to learn about the relationship between Samoa and cultural responsibility. Why is that so important for the team?
There's a massive gap in this country for the appreciation of culture. And so a lot of our girls come from communities where their culture isn't celebrated. You know, they're not as proud as what they should be around being a part of, you know, the oldest continuing culture in the world. We don't have that, and that's probably a very broad and general statement, but we don't have that overwhelming sense of pride for who we are. So it's so important for these young women to grow up with that and see that in action. And I think, you know, you talk about the Pacifica communities, you talk about Samoan people, and the thing that comes to mind, or, you know, your front vision is the pride in where they come from and who they are and in their cultural practices. So for the girls to see that firsthand and to see the beauty in culture, I think is going to be an extremely powerful experience, and we hope that they bring that back into their own lives and communities.
And then just on the rugby league front, in terms of what's happening, what will the girls be seeing? Will it be just some games? Will it be training with women's teams in Samoa? Yeah. What does that look like?
We've got three games. So we'll play two games in Apia, and then one game the girls will go over and play in Savai'i. So we've been invited over to play in Savai'i by the women's and with the women's and under 18s team there. So each of the girls will play three games each. So each of the teams will play three games. We'll then go into schools and do, you know, like this kind of skills workshop, training drills, interactions with the high schools and the primary schools, and just, you know, share whatever we're sharing, whether it be, you know, training drills and then sitting down and having conversations and sharing food and sharing those stories. The relationship has been there for thousands of years. You know, outside of rugby league, there's always been that Pacifica relationship. But for our girls to see it firsthand and to be there and to have that documented and then share that with the wider audiences will be extremely powerful.
Finally, so yeah, you've still got a few months to be working on this and everything. What are you and the team most looking forward to from this trip?
I think it's just going to be what we can bring back. You know, there's going to be some incredible experiences for the girls overseas. The sharing of cultures is something that I'm looking forward to. You know, obviously my kids are Aboriginal Samoan kids, so they get to live in the best of both worlds, building their cultural capabilities and experiences is going to be something that I'm really excited about. And seeing our other girls grow in themselves and hopefully come home and share that with their families and communities is going to be something that I think will leave a really long-lasting impact on these kids.
That was Shani Higgerty speaking there to ABC's Jordan Fennell. Now this week, Rotumans across the region are celebrating Whaiang Rotumta, Rotuman Language Week, which happens around this time every year because May 13th, which was yesterday, is officially Rotuma Day, now on May 13, 1881. Rotuma was annexed by Britain and administration handed over to Fiji. Today, the island's population is roughly 1,500, with majority around 10,000 residing either in Fiji or overseas. And one Rotuman living away from his home island is Dr. Matt Bray, who is a Rotuman emergency doctor based in Melbourne. His ancestors hail from the islands of Ituitu and Whanguta. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He's a former president of the Rotuman Association of Victoria and joins us now. Noi e Māori, Dr. Matt.
Noi Māori Johnson, and noi Māori ngā te koa, everyone who's listening.
Now, May 13th, Rotuma Day, means so much to Rotumans worldwide. Paint us a picture of how Rotumans celebrate this day and why it's so significant.
Yes, thank you, Johnson. As you'd alluded to, May 13 commemorates, interestingly, you say annexed by Britain, but we consider it the day we ceded ourselves. And historically, before it was called Rotuma Day, it was called Session Day. So the day that the seven district high chiefs elected to voluntarily enter into a relationship with Queen Victoria and join the colony of Fiji and the greater British Dominion then. So I think that kind of flips the narrative a bit for a more Independence Day kind of thought about it. And this is something that we are electing to do and to join into the global community in that way. Celebrations around the world kind of center on being together and particularly putting our culture, our dance and our traditional crafts on a platform. So on Rotuma itself, you'll see a katoanga involving dance in particular and dances that might have been prepared for months on end in the lead up to the day. There'll be things like Mane Atela'a, which refers to a kind of a farmers' festival where typically all the best farmers and gardeners across the community will bring the best of their wares, their vegetables and root crops in particular, and distribute prizes for the best, most impressive, heaviest in particular, yams and taro and what have you. And women will display their handicrafts as well. So we saw a lot of that on the island yesterday, and that's a typical annual sort of character. And in the global diaspora, there'll be parts of that, but especially an emphasis on song and dance and commemorating the beautiful island that we come from and our pride in our heritage.
Yeah, Dr. May, it's funny that you mentioned some of the videos from yesterday, because I was watching and I was having a good laugh, because one of the giant yams, they didn't have like one of the scales. They couldn't
hold it. The scale wasn't big enough.
That's right. So they had to get two scales to weigh this giant yam, and it was hilarious. But also I was like, damn, the food must have been so good there yesterday. But
I think it speaks to the fertility of the island, which is a particular point of pride for us, that, you know, we can just produce so much and rely satisfactorily on everything that the land and the land of our ancestors has to give us.
Yeah. In your view, Dr. Matt, what's the biggest challenge Rotumans face today in preserving your language and cultural practices?
Yeah. I think to give a funny metaphor, my grandfather always used to say that Rotumans are the best the lyrebirds of the Pacific. So we have this capacity, like the lyrebird in the Australian bush, to very accurately imitate whatever environment we're in and assimilate well and kind of blend in. So I think that's a useful trait in the global community, of having to be a member of the global community and flexible and find yourself succeeding in whatever context you find yourself. But as more and more of the community move to Fiji and further afield in diaspora, our closeness to the culture and language gets diluted. And the more we have to interact with other communities, the emphasis that we might put on the preservation of language and culture diminishes. So that's why I think it's so great and important that the Ministry of Pacific People in New Zealand have elected to put resources into Rotuman Language Week. And I think in particular, as a fruit of and the COVID pandemic in those years, 2020, 2021, when we couldn't go out and be together, there was suddenly a big emphasis on doing these things online. And Rotuman Language Week kind of got a much bigger platform as a result of that kind of yearning to connect and having to do it in digital spaces. And consequently, it's become a big, not just New Zealand-based, but global thing, and kind of bringing together the Rotuman community internationally and centered around Rotuma Day, May 13th, but certainly for the whole week, becomes a commemoration and a real global conversation around what are we doing to preserve and make our language and culture useful to everyday life, but right. also stronger in everyday life, particularly as our community spreads and our families blend.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned resources, and this week, alongside Rotuman Language Week, you helped to launch the release of a new bilingual Rotuman English children's book, which was also available online with Pacific Kids Learning. Tell us more about that and how people can access the resource.
Yeah, thanks, John. So the book is called Today with Leah, or in Rotuman, Teranite I Male Leah. It's a book that illustrates 7 days in the life of a Rotuman girl who's kind of coming up on the summer festive season and a busy week at school and in her home life, and is written in both English and Rotuman in a very simple phrase form, so as to be an accessible way to teach and learn, and hopefully an interesting way to teach the language to young children in particular. Integrated into the story is various aspects of culture and village life, you know, preparing of garlands, performances, the fara, which is a particular Rotuman tradition over the kind of Christmas or holiday festive season we call Almanea, where kind of like Christmas caroling, except in a boisterous Polynesian kind of way, groups of people will go from village to village or district to district with guitars and ukuleles and regale households or whole villages with singing and dancing, just kind of snuck up on, crept on their doorstep, much like you would Christmas carols. So it illustrates a lot of these different, very unique parts of Rotuman culture and life. And it's available online via Pacific Kids Learning, not quite yet in a hard copy form, but certainly it's one of a number of things in the pipeline, and just my small contribution, I guess, to the global efforts to create more resources for more accessibility for language learning and teaching in the diaspora.
Yeah. Dr. Matt, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us. Whaiaksia.
Whaiaksia, Johnson, and happy Rotuman Day to Rotuman Language Week to all your listeners.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. A quick look at our top story this morning. In PNG, 8 people have been kidnapped in a remote village in Western Province. The alleged kidnappers are reported to be demanding a ransom, and police are warning they'll use lethal force if the hostages are not released. Now, you can listen back to that story and all our stories this morning online at ABC Radio Australia. Our sister Aggie the Bowl will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Thank you very much for joining, having myself and also my co-host Alice Lolo here yesterday. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time.